Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Allison Nugent. She's a staff scientist in the Experimental Therapeutic and Pathophysiology Lab for the National Institute of Health in Washington, D.C. She's also an alum of MSU, graduating in 1996 with a degree in physics. Thanks for stopping by, Allison.
Thank you.
So once again, let's talk a little bit about how your training assisted you in your academic and professional development. Go into as much detail as you feel you need to.
Thank you. So I feel like my training in physics really laid the groundwork for pretty much everything that I do. Even though people don't think about medical imaging as something that involves a lot of physics, it really does. All the techniques we have were invented by physicists. You know, we have the huge staff of physicists at the NIH that help support the technology and also help advance the technology. And I think more than anything, having a degree in physics teaches you how to think about things. It teaches you a systematic way to look at a problem and solve it. And it doesn't really matter what that problem is. You just have to attack it in a systematic way.
So I want to ask a little bit about that. You went and got your PhD in physics at Duke, but yet you were working even at that time on MRI. And so you've obviously had a lot of intersection with both MDs and people in the biological fields. And so can you talk a little bit about whether or not how complementary the interactions are, what strengths you bring that perhaps other people don't have and what strengths they bring that you don't have?
They're extremely complementary, and part of it is because when you go have a training program in a specific field, it's very insular. You know, you stay in that field, everyone has the same questions, basically. And when you start learning about a different field that you've never heard about before and you don't have a lot of experience in, you tend to ask very different questions. So I find that, you know, when some of the MDs talk about, you know, the underlying neurobiology, I might ask questions that they've never thought of. And that goes in both directions, too. When I explain the physics of a technique to them, they have questions that I've never even thought about. And there's a lot of synergy that can go on, and we can kind of both help each other push the research that we're doing forward.
That's very interesting. So your mathematical background, do you have to use it much? I mean, you certainly have to know something about what's happening in the MRI, and there's a lot of mathematical tools at work there. Is that right?
Yes, and we still use a lot of math. Particularly, we do some MEG imaging, which is measures the magnetic fields outside the brain. And it's very complex data, and it takes a lot of signal processing and a lot of kind of high-level mathematical functions to be able to kind of make any sense of it and distill it down to what's really going on in the brain.
Yeah, I've always thought that was fascinating. People see an MRI image, and they think, oh, there's a pretty picture. And if you actually were to explain to somebody that it's essentially a series of signals coming from coils that are then interpreted in light of a variety of information that you must have, field gradients and so forth and so on, it doesn't seem like it's really a picture anymore at all. And yet we convey all the information pictorially. You guys talk about that at all, that the best way to convey information to a patient, for example, is obviously through a picture. So we try to put things into pictographs. I mean, does that make sense?
It does. And it's like you said, it's a good way of summarizing information. But the danger of distilling everything down to one picture is it's really easy to overinterpret. You know, it's really easy to take an image like you see sometimes in magazines or the newspaper, where they'll show a brain image that has some colorful blobs on it and say, oh, now we know what it looks like after people exercise or something random like that. And it's easy to look at that and say, oh, wow, we know where that is in the brain now, when actually those pictures usually come from distilling, you know, 30 minutes worth of data from 50 different people. And it's not a clear-cut answer. This is a probability of where this is occurring in the brain. But there are so many other factors that go into it. You can really... It's easy to misinterpret MRIs when you boil them down to a single image.
Well, I do know that because I've had an MRI in my head. And, of course, there's always pieces of that image that are called high contrast, which have nothing to do with pathology but just have to do with the way your brain, quote-unquote, looks on an MRI, so I know a little bit about that. You've been at the NIH already for 16 years, which is, 35 or 40% of a career. So can you give us a synopsis of sort of how that's gone so far for you, what you've done?
So when I started out, I came right out of graduate school into a job where I was supporting a scientist who had done, he had done pet research, but no MRI, and he wanted to get into MRI
technology. No, you don't
technology.
Mean dogs.
No. It's called PET is positron emission tomography. It's an imaging technique where you inject someone with a radioactive tracer, and then you can measure where that tracer was taken up by different areas of the body. And so when I the first study I did when I got there was to do what's called a dosimetry study. So they wanted to look at the safety of a radioactive tracer and make sure none of the organs in the body were getting too high a dose of radiation. So basically they took whole body images of people, and then I had to sit and trace out all the individual organs in the image and then get the radioactive decay curves for each of those organs to measure the dose in that way. And I remember thinking, I'm a physicist, I am completely unfit for tracing images of spleens, but it was still a good experience, and it kind of made me comfortable with working with images and working with clinical questions and clinical problems in a way I wasn't before.
And then after that, what did you start getting into?
So we did a lot of PET studies, but we also did a lot of MRI studies. These were really wide-ranging. We did studies in people with panic disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder. We did studies where we call it a challenge. So we would give people something that would make their either anxiety worse for a short amount of time or induce depression for a short amount of time, and then it would wear off after 24 hours. And in that way, we could kind of look at different ways that the brain was responding to these pressures and extrapolate from that maybe how your brain responds to just everyday average stressors. And after about 9 or 10 years working in that lab, I switched over to a lab that does primarily treatment studies. So we look at new treatments for bipolar disorder and major depression. And what our lab is particularly interested is in treatments that are rapid acting. So most of the antidepressants you can get today have a really delayed onset. It can be up to 6 to 12 weeks to get the full effect of a medication. And sometimes if the first medication doesn't work and you have to switch, it can be months and months before you're feeling better. So we're trying to develop new treatments that have a fast onset. So within hours or days of taking a dose of the medication, people start to feel better. And we've been using imaging, a wide variety of different imaging techniques to try to understand how these treatments work. And because the drugs act so fast, it's a lot easier to get a lot of information in a short period of time.
So you talked a little bit in your talk in the department yesterday about a technique called MEG that you've been working on recently. Can you talk a little bit about MEG and what does that mean?
Yeah, so MEG, it's very similar to EEG, which many people have actually had. And while EEG measures the electric fields outside your head using little sensors that they stick to your scalp, MEG doesn't touch your head at all, but measures the electric fields or the magnetic fields outside your brain. And the magnetic fields are extremely small, and we have to use very sensitive sensors, and we have to do it all in a shielded room to remove any of the effects of even things like the elevators moving or the cars driving by will change the magnetic fields a little bit. So we've been doing a lot of MEG studies, and one nice thing about MEG is you can see responses that happen in the brain very quickly. So if you show someone, for instance, a picture of a face, at about 100 milliseconds after they see the face, there will be a response in their visual cortex, the back of the brain. And then about 170 milliseconds later, there will be a big response in the area of the brain that actually processes faces. And we can show people faces that have different emotions, and we can see how people who are depressed and people who are healthy, their face responses might be different to faces that show things like fear or anger.
So when you work with a piece of equipment like that, what's the chances something like that will be clinical on a day-to-day basis? Is that likely with fancy detectors? And
they're used clinically to some extent in doing surgical planning for epilepsy, trying to figure out exactly where seizures are coming from in the brain. But it is a pretty expensive technique and doesn't have a lot of clinical applications just yet, so there aren't many clinically, but kind of what we hope is that if we're able to use something like MEG, where we can localize in the brain something is happening, maybe we can develop a marker that could be picked up with EEG, which every single hospital has multiple EEG systems, and even a lot of doctors' clinics have them. They're very affordable.
We're talking mostly about treatment of psychiatric illness and things like that, but just out of curiosity, are you contacted ever, or maybe not you, but since you're in NIH, National Institute of Health, I'm surprised that techniques like that aren't being looked at by, let's see, DOD, where they could say, oh, we could put somebody in this thing and now show them pictures of places. And then if they recognize that place and therefore they have a connection to that place, their brain will light up in a certain way. Is anything like that, to your knowledge, going on? I'm just curious about that.
We actually have a lot of collaboration with the Defense Department, looking at a huge variety of things. One of the big things that the military has been looking at now is treatment of TBI, or traumatic brain injury, which is a big problem with soldiers who were coming back from fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of them have these injuries, and we can do brain imaging to see where things like the white matter tracts that carry information in the brain, how those are disturbed after a traumatic brain injury. But I also know people who are working on studies with pilots and working with sleep deprivation in pilots and trying to see if there are drugs that can improve cognition of people while they're having to stay awake for 12 or 14 hours to pilot a plane. And I know a lot of people kind of want to lead this into lie detection and being able to tell if someone's telling the truth or what they're thinking about. But we're so far removed from that at this point. There might be, it wouldn't surprise me if there are labs at the Defense Research Agency that are, working on things like that. But right now, that is really far away.
So let's talk a little bit more about what we would call the treatment of psychiatric disease. So one of the things you and I chatted about is this idea that for many people, when they think about disease, they think about a wide range of things, from cancer to heart disease and other sorts of things. But when they think about psychiatric illness or illness of the brain, they tend to start to think about people either making choices or being unable to control inner demons or whatever it might be. So how can the things that you do play into a better shedding light on the kinds of things that are actually going on?
Well, I think one of the things that we do is we can really document that there are differences between the brains of people who have depression and people who don't have depression, and that if we treat them successfully, either through drugs or even psychotherapy, talk therapy, we see changes in the brain and brains start to look more like healthy brains. And none of these things are really diagnostic yet. They're more like, group averages, and there's a lot of overlap. But we're really confident that what we're seeing are, differences in the brain. And so it's not a weakness, and there shouldn't be any stigma surrounding it, because it really is, a balance of neurotransmitters that's not quite right, or, a brain structure that's too small, or, connections that aren't being made quite right. And that's what's causing the disease and not anything that the person is necessarily doing.
Now, when you're talking about treatments, I think you mentioned a particular drug. What is that? Is that ketamine?
Yes.
So can you talk about what kinds of things you might be working with to try to actually treat things while you're looking for these mechanistic, let's say, evidence for mechanisms?
So one interesting thing about ketamine is it's not a terribly practical treatment, because it does cause some psychosis or dissociative-like effects where people feel like they're separate from their body or they're floating. And this only happens while we're giving the infusions, which usually last about 40 minutes. And then their depression goes away after that, whereas all those effects are gone. But still, for someone to be able to do a treatment like that, every time they got an infusion, they would need to go into a clinic and be monitored and supervised, which isn't very practical as a real-world treatment for depression. And we do know that there are some very robust brain changes with ketamine. So for instance, certain frequencies of oscillation of brain waves and something called the gamma band increases while someone gets an infusion of ketamine, and that's very robust. And one thing that we've started doing is looking at the metabolites of ketamine in the body. So what does ketamine break down to in the body? And maybe it's one of those things that ketamine's broken down into that's causing the antidepressant effect and not necessarily the ketamine itself. So there have been some animal studies that our lab collaborated on, where they were able to show that one of the metabolites seemed to be effective. And some of the evidence they used was that it produced the same increase in gamma oscillations. So hopefully we might be able to start testing this drug in healthy people and look more in depth at those gamma oscillations and see exactly where in the brain they're coming from and what they're targeting. And that might give us a better idea of not only how to treat depression, but what's causing it.
And if it was one of these resultant things, then presumably it wouldn't have these naughty side effects that
exactly.
the other stuff has.
That's the hope. And it might be something someone can take in a pill, once a week or every few days.
Now, do you work with anybody in gene therapy? I don't know about psychiatric work very much or diseases or the brain. So people are always talking nowadays about potentially doing gene modification and other kinds of things. So is there work going on at NIH about looking at brain function related to genomic expression and things like that?
There's a lot of work, and we collaborate with a genetics department. And we've also collaborated with some large-scale collaborations from 30 or 40 universities and research institutes, where each institute will contribute the genetics and the imaging studies from anywhere from 50 to 100 subjects, so we can look at these thousands of subjects and look at alterations in the genetic profiles. But with the psychiatric disorders, there's no really clear-cut genetic differences, certainly nothing that we could really target with gene therapy, because it's not a single gene. It seems more like it's likely to be a lot of genes that confer a little bit of a risk factor. And so if you have enough of these genes that give you a risk for depression, and then maybe you have additional stressors in your life, that those can kind of interact and cause you to develop depression, whereas someone who didn't have them wouldn't.
Okay, so some people in your group or some people related to your group might be talking to people, let's say, in motor neuron issues or something like that. There's still deterioration in either the spinal region or conceivably in the brain. I know from personal history of that ALS can be related to FTD, which is frontotemporal disorder. And so do people look at those sorts of things too with these kinds of techniques? Can that be studied with things like MEG, do you know?
Yes, and there's a very active group that actually studies motor disorders and human motor function in people who have disorders of movement or tremors. And a lot of those are related to kind of subcortical areas of the brain that are responsible for motion for motor function. And we also have there's the National Institute on Aging. For a long time had a very active group who studied Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And outside the NIH, there are some labs who were looking at Alzheimer's disease and developing PET tracers that can actually bind to amyloid proteins, which build up in the brain in people with Alzheimer's disease. And the hope is that they can identify people who might not have these problems yet, but are going to develop these problems. And once there are treatments that we have that are effective, we can target people who are at risk for the disorder before they start losing cognitive abilities.
On a related note, not exactly related, but one of the things we're interested here at MSU, we're interested in women in the sciences, especially physics and engineering and things like that. So at NIH, when you see the people around you, would you say that the number of women in the field is sort of uniform, or is it more concentrated in the biological areas? Are there a lot of other women physicists, for example? You say there's a lot of physicists there.
I would say that, certainly the biological sciences are, there's a lot of women and representation from women in science. And from the physics end, it's, the representation is smaller as a percentage, but it's definitely growing. And the NIH, as an institution, is very committed to making sure that they remove as much bias as possible and that women in science are recognized for their achievements. And in fact, both the scientific director and the clinical director of our institute are both very accomplished women.
Well, that's great. One of the things that I wonder if you could convey to people who might be listening is this idea that people aren't sure what they would do with a degree in something like physics. You and I have talked a little bit about that. And of course, I have a lot of experience with people going into the defense industry and much less experience with people going into health-related stuff, health-related issues. Obviously, it's a big part of the research that's going on in the country. So would you say that people going into this will have options if they were to go into physics and I wanted to talk to them about what they might do
Absolutely. I think a degree in physics is one of the most versatile degrees you have. And this goes back to one thing I was saying at the beginning, which is that it doesn't just teach you facts or, you know, laws of physics, but it really teaches you a systematic way of thinking and a systematic way of solving problems. And that's really applicable to any field. And in fact, people who were in my graduate program, I know several people who work on Wall Street now doing financial market prediction and computational sciences like that. I know people who went to consulting firms where, you know, they fly around the country and solve problems for industries and businesses. So it's, I really think it's one of the most versatile careers and a career, a degree that's really sought after and that recruiters for different industries really appreciate someone with a physics degree.
Well, Allison, I really appreciate you stopping by. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And once again, you've been listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. This is Dave Cornelson signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.